Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Dan and Peter Haig, and we're approaching the subject of drinks again.
It's a bit of a mixed bag.
It is.
But it's fun anyway, right? No question about that. And who's up first?
Old buddy, yeah. Fred Minnick. Published his latest book, which is all about making mead or about the history of mead.
Yeah, but he said he's not writing any more books right now because he's launching a magazine.
Oh.
Go figure. Whatever it is, I'm sure it'll have a lot about bourbon in it, and you'll be sure to enjoy it. And in the meantime, here's Fred tracing the ultimate,
He's the ultimate recorder of the history of mead.
And mead is where it all began. Okay, well, our upcoming guest, Fred Minnick, I thought he was known as Mr. Bourbon, but apparently he's now also known as Mr. Mead. What caused this need to explore further beverages?
So I have this, never-ending quench for, I'm always thirsty to learn more and study more about different alcohols and, like, the histories of them, where they came from, what cultures inspired them and everything. And in a lot of my research, mead kept coming up. Like, it would... In my book, Whiskey Women, you'll see that there's mentions of it in there. And when I would be looking into, you know, the early whiskeys, you would find a lot of it. Even with bourbon, you would see some odd crossovers. And so I came across a lot of it. And then I'm judging this cocktail contest like 6 years ago. And this young woman uses mead in her cocktail. And I was like, oh, this is pretty cool. And it started kind of planted the seed in my brain that maybe I should look into doing a book on mead. And it just so happens mead started getting trendy, you know, about the time Game of Thrones comes out and some other fantasy quests.
I thought that was a good reference you made. And
thank you.
Yeah, because everybody would pick up on that one right away.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. It's like everything is drinks related, like what we drink. It's often very connected to pop culture.
Uh-huh.
And we saw with, like, James Bond when he drank martinis. We saw it with Mad Men with bourbon.
Yeah.
And I think to an extent you saw it with mead, with Game of Thrones. And while they don't necessarily call it out, that series evokes a certain passion toward that time, and you want to drink like a Viking, essentially, and that's kind of how I came to be with this. Is that I wanted to study it, learn about it, and write about it, and also make it and find cool ways to introduce it to cocktails. So that's kind of how it all started.
Now the interesting thing is mead is a starter in another way altogether, which you mentioned earlier in your book, in that it's undoubtedly, although we can't be sure it was 9,000 years ago, whatever it was mm-hmm. early in the game when it came to alcoholic beverages, because there weren't any other ones.
Yeah, and the way I've kind of, my belief in this is that mead is the very first branded alcohol. So, like, okay. Before we called it ale or beer or wine, or certainly for whiskey or any kind of spirit, you know, they had a name for it. It was mead, and so it was, or honey wine. So they had, like, this early definition, and you would even find, like, guidelines toward making, you know, certain styles. And it's very historically significant to all cultures, all ancient cultures, the ancient Greeks, the ancient Romans, you know, the areas that the Romans conquered, like the Gauls and the Visigoths. And also places like Ethiopia. Ethiopia is kind of this country that no one really gives a lot of credit to for their alcohol contributions. And they were making a variant of mead called Tej that I believe is actually served in the Bible when King Solomon meets with Queen Sheba. So there's this.
Yeah, I love that
story.
There's
this, like, really historic connection to all of these countries.
And strangely, you say that they drank it even in Muslim countries in ancient history.
Yeah, I mean, mead was everywhere, and you would. In fact, there was like when there was the Crusades going on, the Polish the Pope had asked for Poland's help, and the Prince of Poland at the time said, "I'm sorry, we cannot assist you because there's not mead in Jerusalem to serve, you know, my knights." So, like, mead's got a lot of really, you know, unique connections to battles. So the Goths would drink it, the Gauls would drink it before battle, the Vikings would drink it before, during, and after battle, and you would see all of these, like, really kind of, like, grotesque poems, you know, calling out the death of enemies and so forth, and mead would be right there in the thick of it.
Tell us, let's go back, and have you got a definition of mead down to its simplest form?
Well, it's a hard one to simplify because there's so many variants. But what I have kind of created in my brain is that, you know, taking a little bit from my whiskey side, is that it's the majority of the base has to be at least 51% honey. So from, like, the alcohol, from where the alcohol is derived, you know, the base has to be at least 51% honey. So you'll see, like, a lot of variants. The lot of things like maple syrup, they'll add wine, grape juice, or they'll add, you know, apple juice or other things to kind of, you know, ameliorate their flavor that they're looking for. And then you'll have some that are basically just honey and water and yeast, and it's meat. But
so it's fermented. It's not distilled. Yeah. It's fermented.
Yeah, it's fermented. It's not distilled. So, and there's certainly the government has in the last like modern craft bill, the tax modernization that just passed, and the Trump administration, there was a call out to alcohol percentages on mead. So, I mean, the government has recognized what mead is and what mead can be. And the thing is like, you can't, if you are a package store and your license only has beer, you can't sell mead. Because mead, by the government's law, is considered wine. So, like, you apply for a winery license if you want to make mead, for example. So it's one of those, although it's really our first real alcohol, it's kind of fallen to the wayside of like federal definitions.
Uh-huh. Now, it's interesting though that, if you like, you start off with mead as being a very simple concoction, where the key ingredient is honey, and then you've got some little buggers of yeast to get involved to convert some of the sugars into alcohol, and that's your mead. But you you discovered lots and lots of other ways, or if you like, adulterating mead to make for a wide range of different flavors to appeal to a wide variety of different tastes.
Yeah, and it would vary per culture. You know, like the Polish were very into, they were about like letting the honey kind of speak for itself, and they would have different levels of honey versus, you know, and water levels that they would add, and they would end up, you know, kind of branding those for the Polish mead. And the Russians would add fruits, and the British, you know, the ancient British would add spices. So you had, it's very fascinating because they would do things based on, like, what they had around them and what they liked to taste. And that's why, like, I go back to Ethiopia, you know, they were using, they're adding gesho bark to create tej, and that's T-E-J. And they create, and that gesho bark was really used before hops, and it was like a bittering agent. It's from the bark of like a buckthorn tree out there. So it's very, very bitter, and it can create like this really incredible, you know, dry, you know, feels, taste, might taste a little hoppy with some sweet notes to it, like a sweet back. And it's just gorgeous, gorgeous stuff. And every culture would have a different style, if you will.
Now, we talked with a couple of very, very famous, very well-known makers of Italian wines, not only currently but in as well. But they spoke to us about the history of wine itself and said, well, you know, the original wines the Romans drank was all very sweet, almost, if you like, as sweet as mead.
The
reason that they made it sweet is because that was a way to make it last until the next harvest would come along. Because if the wine spoiled, there wouldn't be any more until next year.
You know, I think that they put it in those like jars and would like keep them in cellars or would bury them. But you know, the Romans, they had mead in their on their menu. You know, they would drink mead, but it was not as sought after as wine. And I think that's the big kind of like study of the Roman culture, is like what the particular territories would drink. Some of them would drink wine and some of them would drink mead. And there was a lot of politicians in Rome who would actually say you can tell a lot about a culture by if they drink mead. They thought mead was like for a simpleton and wine was for more of a refined person.
Got it. Okay. Now let's go back to this wonderful book, Mead, the Libations, Legends, and Lore of History's Oldest Drinks. As people dive into the book, what are they going to find?
Yeah, I think you're going to find like something that changes your mind, your perceptions of what mead is. And I think you're going to find that there's a lot of really cool culture and a lot of like cocktail potential behind it. I tried to break down mead by what I perceive to be the most dynamic honey production and ergo mead producers of the times. And I ended up following kind of like a chronological system, but it was really, you know, really starts in the beginning with like the ancient Greeks, goes to the ancient Romans, and then it starts dabbling into the various cultures like Ethiopia, Poland, England, Russia. These are all cultures that have a huge impact on mead and how it's produced. And with each one of those, I would tell their story and like how mead was perceived in their country and how it was consumed. And then I would create cocktails based on that. So like for Russia, you know, it basically Russia was a heavily mead centric country, to the point that they created special devices just to drink out of mead, just to drink special meads. And when vodka comes on the scene, you know, mead goes away because they have something else to drink. But, you know, but for like the Russian cocktail section, I have a Vesper that's made with mead. And so it's like it's a mead Vesper. For like the American section, you know, I've got some areas where, you know, mixing with bourbon. So I try to create cocktails, and the mixologist I work with for this book try to create cocktails that would really capture that particular culture.
And you know, it's like we know you well enough and you work well enough to know that you get an awful lot more information than just about the basics of mead in this book. I, first of all, didn't realize how little I know about Polish history until I read this. And the other thing is, you know an awful lot about bees. I didn't know there were that many varieties of it, and your explanation about how this whole process works is the clearest presentation of honey making by bees that I've ever read.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, and that was kind of, I guess, you know, when you look at it, when you are studying an alcohol, you're really, you end up studying the base from which it's made. So, like, when I'm studying bourbon, a lot of it comes down to, like, the early plantings of corn, or with rum, it's the, you know, the first creations of molasses. You know, you have to study that base. And with mead, of course, it comes from honey. And you can't have honey without
bees.
And bees. And you basically have this, you had all of these people creating new mechanisms to better harvest honey. And, you know, once upon a time, you had people just rushing in there and grabbing the honey, and they'd get stung. Someone probably got stung to death. You know, and eventually somebody figured out by having smoke, you know, they would move away.
I never understood that until you. Yeah, when you explained it, I understood. I couldn't figure out why people were always having fires with smoke.
Well, it anesthetizes them, right?
I don't know.
Doesn't it anesthetize the bees?
So basically, when you have smoke, what do you do when you see smoke? You see smoke, you think fire, you run. It's kind of the same instinct. They want to get away from what is an apparent danger.
So they want fly. They want to. What is it? What is that term from psychology? You flee or you.
fight or flight.
Fight or flight.
Yeah, and some people will find out they get stung. So, there's a little bit of fight in them.
Sure there are.
But, this whole thing with killer bees, I'm always terrified of killer bees. I mean, I've had stories where they've eaten whole cows and things.
That's
a killer bee.
That's pretty terrifying.
Yeah, it's they were bred. Two different species or something, right?
Yeah. So there's all these. There's always been this effort to create better, better yielding bees, and like right now there's an effort to create bees that are immune to certain types of mites. Or certain types of
pesticides,
certain types of diseases, and so there's always an ongoing effort of like creating new breeds, and you know the American bee is so bred that each one of them are probably really a hodgepodge of like an African bee, a Russian bee. You know, so there's all these different types of bees that are just kind of floating about.
Yeah, well, I mean, they serve a function, but, I mean, I never understood hornets, for example. What do they do?
They sting you.
They sting you, they sting you in the bum.
They build this.
So they still pollinate. So things like...
they do pollinate hornets?
Yeah, but, you know, they do. So they, not to the extent of bees. Like butterflies pollinate, bees are the main pollinator of the world, and without bees, Albert Einstein theorized that we would be without, we would all wither away and die eventually. Basically, said that we would
cease to exist. I was trying to remember which intellectual you quoted that I was surprised by the quote. Yeah,
and in fact, the fact is too, and this is a big piece to. This is a big piece to the, my passion for mead, is that we're looking at a time where we're facing environmental consequences.
Right.
I think we need to be more aware of what we are consuming.
Mm-hmm.
And when you consume mead, you are essentially consuming something that is good for the environment. Because the base is pollinating the world. It's an effort to pollinate the world. When you consume something from, and I love beer and I love whiskeys and rums and all that, I mean, those are much harder on the environment than mead would be at the end of the day, because they, a lot of them require pesticides, they require, cultivation needs, and mead really, it comes from something that's giving, is pollinating. It's out there, it's actively pollinating and helping the environment. So I like encouraging things like this. Right. And if I can encourage one or two people or 1,000 to buy a bottle of mead, I feel like I've done my job.
Yeah, that's a good point you make. Yeah, well, Peter's brother lives in a small village in Cornwall, England, called St. Agnes. And for years, one of the highlights of the central, I call it the Central Business District. You'd laugh. It's about one block, one street. But anyhow, was the meadery. That was the place you would go if you were going to go out.
And the kids used to love going to the meadery because they of course thought they were getting something alcoholic, which I'm sure they weren't. but the meadery has closed.
Yeah, it's closed.
Sadly, the meadery is no more.
So Frank, you did a book on rum, did you?
I did. We talked about it last year together.
Because it's, did we say it was, because I'm getting all these books about rum now, and all these, what was it? We had rum aged in vermouth
barrels. Yes, yeah.
All kinds of stuff going on with rum now.
Yeah, rum's a very hot and happening spirit, and some of the best rum in the world is being produced. Some of the best rum of all time is being produced right now.
Right. In Puerto Rico?
I think Barbados and Jamaica are the really strong countries.
Mm-hmm.
Puerto Rico is fine. They've got, the largest rum distillery there in Bacardi, and that, that gets into a lot of doors just because of the monetary effort that they bring.
Oh, but, sure, right.
But they're also lighter in style rum, so they're more, I tend to like rums that are heavy and full-bodied. Mm-hmm. A lot of people will call them dark rums, but that's not a very legitimate term. You can't really, follow that in comparison to like you can with bourbon. Like bourbon has a lot of terms that you can that are defined and thoroughly protected under federal guidelines. Whereas rum has a lot of fanciful terminology that just like gold and silver and dark. Those are all fancy.
Right. Well, I don't know, but I mean, the only dessert I know how to make is rum cream pie. But since we don't drink it, it's pretty heavy-duty stuff. One bottle will last probably 10 years.
Yeah. Good rum is good rum.
Yeah.
You just got to find the right rum.
Well, anyway, we're sliding off the subject of mead. I'll bet there are any number of cocktail recipes in your book which involve bringing mead and rum together.
As a matter of fact, yeah, let me pull one up. I've got one that, let's see. Let me find a good one. Nope. Yep, here we go. It's a Viking toddy. And
okay.
It's 1.5 ounces of mead, 3/4 ounces of Mount Gay rum, 1 tablespoon of honey, hot water, lemon juice, black tea, loose leaf, or bagged. I'm a loose leaf guy myself.
Mm-hmm.
And, put it in a clear mug, garnish it with the lemon wheel. It's a real tasty drink.
It sounds like what I take for a cold.
Yeah, it sounds like the cure for the common cold.
Absolutely.
You didn't realize you were writing prescriptions.
Yeah.
Fred, what's your next spirit you're doing?
Right now I'm not actually working on a book. I'm launching a magazine.
called Bourbon Plus.
Comes
out this fall.
Good.
Yeah, so I'm the editor-in-chief of that. And I have, I'm affiliated with the Bourbon and Beyond Festival. I'm a co-founder of that. This year we have Lenny Kravitz, John Mayer, Robert Plant, Sting. We got a lot of great musical headliners. And on the chef side, we've got Tom Colicchio and Aaron Sanchez. And,
yeah.
All kinds of great.
Why aren't we on your mailing list for that? We should be on your mailing list. I haven't got anything.
Oh, awesome. Awesome.
So you... Well, no, it's not awesome. I didn't get anything about it.
Oh, you didn't get anything about it?
Yeah.
You're not on my mailing list?
I don't think so.
All right, well, sign up for my email at fredminnick.com. I'm not someone who just adds people. I want people to sign up for stuff.
Mm-hmm. All right. Okay, and yeah, so it would be interesting to get your magazine too. I'll spring for a subscription of that for my husband.
Oh, right on. Well, yeah, you can sign up for that at bourbonplus.com. Bourbonplus.com.
Bourbon.
And fredminnick.com is your.
Yep.
Your other activities.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Well, Fred, it's always a pleasure to welcome you to the program. And it's almost the cocktail hour. I wonder if we have any mead in the liquor cabinet.
I bet.
Unfortunately, I bet we don't.
Maybe some old stuff that you just don't even know about. It's kind of
probably
kinda
all
back there. And
all the way in the back, right?
Yeah.
Okay, Fred. Well, thank you for talking to us. And good luck with your varied oncoming activities, adventures.
Awesome. Thank you so much for your time. It's always always a pleasure.
Yeah.
Guys, take
Thanks.
Care.
Bye-bye.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
And don't go away, because we'll be back after a very short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.com. .net.
Way back in the beginning, we knew that this company and the product Q-Tonic was going to be sensational. It tasted sensational. It was just what everyone was looking for. And, well, we're going to talk to Jordan Silbert, a follow-up from our very beginning interview with him.
Who had the idea in the first place.
Right.
Amazing. The whole story is just so much fun.
He is fun, and he's really dedicated, and his mission is one we all support.
And not only that, but he just sent us another box of Q soft drinks. Which
grapefruit mixer.
Which Miss Anne is undoubtedly going to demolish unless I get there first.
Well, you know, we sort of had an inkling about this company when we interviewed them in 2008 that they were going to go somewhere. Peter adores the product. And we're talking to Jordan Silbert of Q-Tonic, and you've grown. You were the fastest growing what?
In the premium mixer company in the United States right now.
Wow.
High or high again. It's been a long but fun 10 years since I last did this with you.
Now,
yeah.
What did you do before?
Nothing to do with nothing. That's probably why it took so long to get to where we are today.
But seriously, you must have had a regular job, even though you lived in Brooklyn.
The previous job to starting this company was doing post 9/11 rebuilding. So my job was to come up with ideas and get them funded and implemented for the area surrounding the former World Trade Center site in Manhattan. And I did a lot with telecommunications and technology. Before that, I worked for a couple of technology companies out in California.
That must have been very difficult work to do, I'm guessing.
Yeah, but also incredibly rewarding until it got really political. And before that, it got ugly, didn't it?
Yeah, well, they were fighting over it. Everybody said, I have control.
Right. For the first year or two, it was great, and everybody was just on the same team and wanted to help and make things better. And so if I came up with an idea and found the resources to do it, people, you know, let me do it. But then a couple of years in, it got really, people were fighting over power and stuff like that.
Dear.
It wasn't enjoyable or even productive.
So you must have been looking for something else to do. So I had
this idea while I was working there.
Okay.
I was working really hard, and I'm from Manhattan, and that's why I moved back from California after 9/11 to help my city. And I had a bunch of friends, and I was living at the time in Brooklyn, and I had this beautiful backyard, and it was a warm summer night, and a bunch of our friends over for gin and tonics, and we were drinking drink after drink, and a couple drinks in, my teeth got sticky. I was like, that's kind of weird. I looked at the bottle of Schweppes and looked at the ingredients, 28 grams of high fructose corn syrup, natural and artificial flavors, sodium benzoate. I was like, that's kind of weird.
What the hell is that, right?
Exactly. One of my good friends is telling the same stupid story he always tells. So I thought about it for a second, and another one of our friends, then girlfriend, now wife and mother of his two kids, she was drinking Sprite. Her, stomach was upset or something. So I was like, hey, Sarah, can I look at your Sprite for a second? She gave me the can. 28 grams high fructose corn syrup, natural artificial flavors, sodium benzoate. I was like, guys, that's crazy. These are the same thing. One's just green and the other one's yellow. And being my good friend, they totally ignored it. But gin has a real way of, I don't know if it does this for you, but it has a real way of clarifying my thinking, really focusing me on the important things in the world. I don't know, a couple more drinks in, I guess this was at a point in my life where I could have, 5 or 6 gin and tonics on a Tuesday night and be pretty good on a Wednesday morning, especially I was doing something that I enjoyed doing that felt really meaningful, so, I would do pretty good in the morning even after drinking. And I looked up and I realized everything was perfect about that night. It was beautiful weather, we had the Christmas lights strung up in the backyard, my best friends in the world were there, it was great gin. And everything was perfect except for the tonic water.
Okay. Yeah, well, I think
as I looked at it, I was like, what a piece of crap. the label's peeling off. I obviously knew what was in the bottle. The bottle's crusty on top. And I was thinking, why is there not a better tonic water? Why is there not a tonic water as good as this night or as good as a gin or as good as my friends? I was like, you know what? I'm going to make a better tonic water.
Now, the funny part about it, Jordan, is we have friends who always try to buy British-made Schweppes tonic water, which at least is made with natural sugar, not this high fructose corn syrup. But they still haven't gone to the same trouble as you have to have all of the ingredients necessary to making a superior tonic water.
Yep. I agree. And it was, for me, I didn't know anything. When my head cleared the next day, I figured out why tonic water was so lousy in America, that basically the big soda companies had treated it like a soda, which is how do you make the cheapest possible thing rather than how do you make the most delicious thing. So I figured out that tonic water was supposed to have this bark of a tree native to Peru, this Cinchona tree. And so I ordered a bag of bark on the Internet, and I started taste mixing it with little sugars. I tried different ones. I thought agave tasted the best. Then I started mixing stuff up in my kitchen, and my roommate at the time thought I was running, starting a meth lab or something. I had, pots and pans. It was an absolute mess. But eventually I made something pretty good. I made a quinine syrup, which people loved. But by that point I was down a rabbit hole, and the bubbles were driving me nuts because I was just, making a syrup and topping it with gin and club soda. But in order to really get the tonic water fizzy, you need to make it at a commercial, like an industrial facility. And you guys, I'm sure, have consumed a lot of gin and tonics over your lives, but one of the things that drives me most nuts, and again, granted, I started a premium mixer company, one of the things that drives me most nuts is a flat gin and tonic. It's just something's wrong with the world when your gin tonic isn't fizzy.
Oh, right.
So I found a soda plant that would make my my tonic water. And then I posted on a foodie website, hey, does anybody want to try my tonic water? And Jim Meehan, who at that point was at Gramercy Tavern, later obviously went on to start PDT, wanted to try it. And I went down to Gramercy Tavern. He said, this is great. I want to buy it. Who's your distributor? I was like, distributor?
What's one of those?
Yeah, he said, go get set up with finance. So I did that. By the time I got home, got a call from Sasha from Milk and Honey, who probably more than anybody is responsible for kind of the rise rebirth of terrific cocktails in America. He wanted to try it. He loved it. And he knew I didn't know anything. So he said, can you deliver it after close tonight? So I borrowed a car, and I delivered my first cases at 2:30 in the morning, and Sasha paid me cash out of the register.
Wow.
And I want to say
story.
We've been off and running, but that was, almost 12 years ago now.
You have two different tonic waters, though, in your portfolio. We'll go into the extension of the portfolio, but while we're on the subject of tonic, why do you have one called tonic water and the other called Indian tonic water? What's the difference?
So we have seven flavors. We have kind of a whole line of premium mixers, the two tonic waters, club soda, ginger ale, ginger beer, a sparkling grapefruit, which is for Palomas, and a cola.
Yeah, I didn't get to taste that grapefruit. That's the one I really wanted to taste, and Peter drank it all.
We should fix that. You should. My wife's drinking all of it. She's drinking it with mezcal this summer and absolutely loving it.
Mezcal? My goodness. That sounds interesting, doesn't it?
Yeah. So anyway, go back to Paul's question. We have two different tonic waters. One's our original, that Q tonic, and the other one's Q Indian tonic. And they are different expressions. The first tonic water is really clean, really dry. It's sweetened with organic agave and really not much of it, which enables the subtleties in a gin to really shine. I love gin. When I'm not drinking gin and tonics, I drink straight gin. And I love all of the subtleties in a great, great gin. It is, as you guys know, a phenomenal time to be a drinker right now. There are so many awesome spirits, and each and every one, the master distiller is agonized over the shape of the still, how many times to fire through the still, what botanicals to use, whether to age it, all these other things. But if you don't use good mixer, you can't taste any of those subtleties. And a lot of mixers have way too much sugar, and sugar is a masking agent. You know, think about when you start drinking, you drink, wine coolers or Tang and Everclear. And basically what you're trying to do is hide the taste of the spirit. But if you're drinking a $30 bottle of gin, or whiskey or rum, you want to taste those subtleties that the master distiller agonized over. So that original tonic we made is super, super dry, so you could taste all those subtleties. It does particularly well with these so-called New Age or New American gins, the Dorothy Parkers, Death's Door, Hendrix, gins of the world, the ones that are a little less juniper forward and have more other stuff going on that's pretty interesting.
And so
our original tonic water lets those subtleties truly shine.
It
was purpose-built for London dry gins, which are obviously bigger. You know, they're more junipery. And I think needs kind of a bigger tonic water, one that's a little more bitter and a little sweeter to stand up to those bigger gins.
You know, we should get you in touch with this Psalm. He's a chef and a sommelier, but he's so into gin and tonic that he produces his own gin.
Yep.
And he would love it. We've got to get you.
Well, sounds like he and I would get along well because I produced my own tonic water.
I that would be great.
One of the things we didn't know, by the way, this is a did you know about, and the answer is, what is the most popular country in the world for gin and tonic?
Yeah, I know.
And the answer is Spain.
Yes. Yeah. The whole thing, and the gin tonic over there is huge right now.
Yeah, and they have huge glasses. I mean, they have glasses like those tulip glasses that the Belgians serve their beer in that are just immense.
Yeah. Or like King Arthur drank his wine in.
or something like that. Well, yeah. King Arthur drank his mead.
Mead,
in, yes.
And we would have more about mead in the program if Fred Minnick would show up when he was supposed to for his interview.
Yeah. Do you know, I'm hooked on something called organic raw agave sap. Do you know what that is?
It's so I assume that's agave nectar is what we sweeten
that's
our
it.
Stuff with,
that's, yeah.
Which is the kind of the nectar that comes out of the agave plants. When it's fermented, it turns into tequila, or that some people turn it into tequila and mezcal. But that's the sweetener we use, and it tastes wonderful. It has a fullness and a richness, and that's the sweetener
we use. It has a vegetal like tinge to it.
Yeah, it does, and it just has a in the same way that sugar is a blank slate. It really just has sweetness with no depth or complexity, and that's nice in a lot of ways. The agave has like a fullness and a roundness, and yeah, a little earthiness to it. And we use that in almost virtually all of our flavors. When I did the first recipe, I tried out 15 different sweeteners, obviously sugar, then cane sugar, beet sugar, honey, all these different ones. And agave, frankly, just tasted the best. And that's why we used it then, and we continue to use it. It's much more expensive than the other options, but I think it tastes a lot better.
Yeah, a jar of this stuff that I'm taking, I'm testing out a teaspoonful a day. It's supposed to fix everything for you. I don't know what exactly, but it's supposed to do wonders. It's a pre as well as a probiotic. It's like a small jar. It's like $25.
Hmm. Jesus. Yeah. Makes my tonic water seem cheap.
Yeah, almost as much as one of his bottles of tonic water. listeners, let's take the sticker shock out of this for you. This is not your supermarket half-gallon bottle of Schweppes tonic water, maybe you like it unsweetened as well.
We've actually come a long way since we talked 10 years ago.
Yeah.
One of the things I've been working on, and there's all these, you know, when you actually buy more bottles and more cans, you get it for a cheaper price. So our cans, we have a 4-pack of cans, which is 7.5 ounces. Are at, you know, $4.99 or $3.99 around the country. We have 4 packs of 6.7-ounce bottles, which are at, you know, $4.99, $5.99, or $6.49 over the around the country.
But I like the thing you sent us. It's a box with a sampler.
Oh, that's just for special people, and I think that's available on Amazon as well. But it's 7 bottles.
Oh, I love it!
It's like a sampler kit.
It'd be great as a gift for the holidays.
Yeah, yeah. We've been talking to a bunch of big liquor store chains about that. We'll see. We're trying to get it in for the holidays, and unfortunately, we don't get to decide at all. But I think it's available on Amazon now.
It's very elegant. There's no question about that.
I think that would be a great gift.
And elegant goes with gin. I mean,
exactly.
It does these days. It didn't used to.
Right.
No, these days, certainly.
Are you familiar with the story of Dutch courage?
I assume that's the history of gin, right?
It's the history of gin, but the reason it's called Dutch courage is it was brought over to England by the soldiers of William of Orange, who came to marry the Queen of England, whose name was Mary the Third, I think, or Mary the Second. And his soldiers used to get a tot of gin every day as part of their rations.
That's awesome.
And it was called Dutch courage because obviously it's what motivated them to fight.
Yeah.
otherwise they would not have been able to do that. And the British Navy decided to copy it, except they used rum instead.
Yeah. Yep.
And I don't know whether the British Army still gets a ration of tonic every day, but the Navy
not
gets
tonic. There was something about gin recently that I think they finally stopped getting it or something. I forget.
You're probably right.
Now, I mean, what is your long range strategy here? I mean, you already have so many flavors. How many total?
We have 7. So we have those 2 tonic waters.
Yeah.
The original tonic water and the Indian tonic water. Then we have a ginger beer, a ginger ale.
Yeah.
A club soda. A grapefruit and a cola. I guess the theory is that every time someone makes a highball, whether it be a gin and tonic, a Moscow Mule, a Paloma, or even a vodka soda, the carbonated mixer should be as good as the spirit that you mixed it with. And people drink a lot of highballs and premium spirits. Something like two-thirds of all premium spirits, cut spirits in the U.S. By dollar are premium, you know, absolute vodka and above. So people are having a lot of drinks out there.
Yeah, somebody just released a highball glass.
Yeah, I think they did. Yes.
Yeah.
Riedel, of all people.
They're pleasant, especially, you know, summertime in Brooklyn right now. It's a great drink, and you should have a mixture of comparable quality and sophistication. And until us and basically Fevertree started, it didn't really exist. You couldn't buy a better, as you said, you couldn't buy a better tonic water in America until maybe 5 or 10 years ago. And my goal is, you know, I started this so that I could drink a better gin and tonic, but my goal is to enable everybody who wants to have a better gin and tonic or a better Moscow Mule or a better Jack and Ginger or Whiskey Ginger or a better Paloma to easily get one and have it be delicious. You know, this world
it's a little crazy
and scary. You might as well have a good drink.
Well,
the world is certainly crazy and scary.
It's a fantastic story. You've revealed one of the sources, always a very good source, called Amazon as a source of supply. I'm guessing that you're probably in Whole Foods and a few other places like that, too.
Oh, we're more than that. We're at Kroger, Target, Safeway, Albertsons. We're at most retailers in America these days. Most major retailers in America.
Are you surprised at how easy a sell it is?
No. So, no and, yeah, no is the answer. Like, it just made perfect sense to me that first night. Again, gin has a real good way of clarifying my thinking. But it made perfect sense to me. And every time I have 5 seconds to explain what I figured out to somebody else, they're like, oh, yeah, that makes perfect sense. And so I actually thought it would be easier. And what I've found over the last 10 or 12 years is that every step away from the consumer is harder, has been harder for me. The consumer from day one got it. Like if I ran into you in a bar and I'd say, hey, I got a better tonic water to mix with that gin. Do you want it? Then you taste it. You say, this is better. I want to buy it. But it's then getting a retailer to carry it, and you got to call the right guy and get the right meeting and have him listen to you, and then you have to have a distributor be able to give it to the deliver it to them, and the distributor has to have enough stock in their warehouse and all of that. That's been the hard part. The consumers have got it from day one. It's all the logistics around it that's been harder.
Well, are you ongoing R&D in a big way?
I'm sorry, say that again?
Do you have ongoing R&D, research and development, in a big way?
Do you mean just drinking gin tonics on a nice weekend afternoon?
I do plenty of that. That's what you do, right?
We don't know. We have 7 flavors that now. It's not like we need 46 different flavors. It's not like we need, like, peach tonic water or anything.
Thank you.
We want to have, you know, stuff that you normally have in your house, which is, you know, tonic water, ginger beer, club soda, stuff like that, just done really, really well. And we want to be big enough that we can do it at an affordable price so that people can go to their regular grocery store and get a better mixer at a price that's, you know, less than the price of coffee.
Here's hoping that the Trump administration doesn't continue its trade war with Europe and make it more difficult for Europeans to be able to get this elixir as well.
I agree, though some of that's just us. Like, we're growing so quickly in the U.S. You know, we get inquiries from European importers all the time, and it's just we're growing so quickly in the U.S. and just focused here. Something I've been trying to do to go to Europe and get it going there. Yes, it is going to be happening, just not immediately. But, yeah, I hope Trump doesn't put up any huge tariffs.
Oh, please.
Well, Jordan, thank you so much.
Jordan, it's so much fun talking to you. I feel like we've sort of in on the birth of this whole thing.
Yes, and let it not be another 10 years.
Right. Okay. So, anyhow, I'm going to look for it at our local Whole Foods to see if I can get my grape juice sample.
You're in Pittsburgh?
Yes.
Yes. So,
Market District should have it as well.
Oh, good. Okay. Very good. All right, Jordan, continue.
Do you need another grapefruit, by the way? Did your husband drink that? Or
he drank it.
Yeah, he drank it.
Okay, we'll figure out how to send you another grapefruit, because it's great with tequila or even mezcal.
Yeah, we don't actually stock mezcal, although I like it. I think it's an overlooked drink, an underrated drink.
So, somehow or other, we'll find out how to consume all the cube beverages you can send.
That would be wonderful. Thank you.
Okay.
Take care, Jordan.
Thanks, Jordan.
Okay, see ya.
Bye.
Bye.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Do you get if you cross two nuts and a ginger field?
Good question.
When you hear the interview, you'll understand the question. Oh, but anyway, we're going to be talking about the ginger people. One of my favorite things in the whole world is ginger and turmeric. And we're going to talk to Abby Leeson about their company, which is a genius company called the Ginger People. And we're going to be talking a lot about the drinking the ginger, and I've learned that actually the company produces some booklets on cooking with ginger, so we may have a follow-up interview somewhere down the line on cooking with ginger. But right now, let's just have the introductory discussion with Abby Leeson of the Ginger People. Well, anybody who listens to us regularly on the menu, I will know that I am a fanatic fan of ginger and turmeric. And so I'm about to pick my new best friend, who is Abby Leeson, is it? Leeson. Abby Leeson.
Leeson.
Who is, with her husband, runs a company called The Ginger People. And they also, what a perfect company for me to be interviewing, I must say. Abby, people are always asking me how I met my husband, Peter, who's English and was living in Australia, and I was living in Philadelphia. But I'm going to ask you, I mean, that's not really a very interesting story for the program, but I'm going to ask you how you started your company, The Ginger People, and when, and that will bring us to the subject of meeting your husband. Tell us your story.
Sure, Ann. My husband and I met in the early 80s. I lived in California, and he was from Sydney, Australia. And he was involved in a macadamia business, and I was in the almond industry, so we met over nuts. And and macadamias are actually indigenous to Australia. Many people think it's Hawaii, but they originated in Australia. And they grow right next door to ginger.
Right.
And when my husband was involved in the macadamia industry, he was approached by the Queensland Ginger Farmers Cooperative to assist them with introducing ginger or growing awareness of ginger in the U.S. because he was traveling back and forth between Australia, Hawaii, and California and working as a consultant in the macadamia industry. So
Was what year? 1984.
That was 1984,
and that was early on. Before, I mean, now everybody I think has heard about the health benefits of ginger, but that was
absolutely
pretty early.
It was pretty early for the U.S. and the U.S. has a ways to go with ginger and their knowledge. You go to Europe, England in particular, Canada, the Canadians know ginger a bit more. It's in their heritage. And the U.S. was very, in the early 80s, they weren't that familiar with ginger. And, but now, you know, there's a greater awareness of the health benefits of ginger and turmeric, which is also in the ginger family. So we're finally enjoying, you know, what we worked so hard at in the early 80s and the 80s and into the 90s, where people weren't sure about it or what it was good for, that it just went into stir fry. And it goes, ginger can go into anything and everything. we feel like we're just getting started, and we've been doing it over 30 years.
Well, you know, I mean, I'm a good testimonial for ginger because eating for a living, which I've done for years and years and years, you tend to be running the risk of food poisoning frequently. and I have the remedy down pat is even in hotels in Europe, I will ask for minced or chopped as finely as possible, fresh ginger root steamed in hot water, I mean steeped mm-hmm. in hot water for a tea, and that's what I will consume then for 2 days, and it gets me back on my feet.
Well, ginger has antibacterial properties,
mm-hmm.
and there's a story of the time when there were sailing ships and they had meat, that they would carry meat on these sailing ships,
ooh.
And as the story goes, they would rub ginger on the meat to keep it from,
really?
You know, going rancid. So, yeah, that your story makes perfect sense.
Well, you know, and also, I mean, I found that you can put it with turmeric. And mm-hmm. I frequently have ginger, turmeric, fresh turmeric root sliced in green tea with black pepper, because you need to have the black pepper as a, you know,
yeah.
a starter
wow.
for it. Yeah. So I should be really healthy.
Putting all those together. And both ginger and black pepper are supposed to help the bioavailability of turmeric, meaning, you know, turmeric's hard for the body to absorb, but when you add ginger and black pepper to it, it helps with the absorption.
Right.
Turmeric. So, yeah, you're just making the whole thing work together.
Good. I'm so happy because it stains well, everything it touches. My teeth are yellow.
I guess that's the one downside of turmeric. Another challenge of turmeric is it's hard to make turmeric taste good. There's so many new products out on the market right now with turmeric. And turmeric, you got to be honest about it, it has a very earthy, you could say dirty taste, but
by
adding other wonderful things like the ginger and the black pepper, we add a little bit of coconut milk to some of our turmeric products. And when our focus is to make ginger and turmeric taste delicious and healthy at the same time, and you can.
Well, you have so many products. I mean, you didn't start out with all of these, I'm sure. How did you start? Like with just like tea or something?
We actually started with ginger cooking sauces. Those were our first products. I love to cook.
Yeah.
So we worked with a restaurateur, and we met and came up with what our favorite sauces were. And we started with four sauces that were all very ginger-centric. We like to put a lot of ginger in our products. And that's where we started. It was in the kitchen cooking.
Mm-hmm.
From there, we went on to... We discovered ginger candy from Indonesia. They're very good candy makers, and fresh ginger grows in Indonesia. Fresh ginger grows in many of the tropical areas of the world, lots of islands. But ginger requires a tropical, subtropical climate, high rainfall, really good soil drainage, because ginger can suffocate very easily, and so it needs a lot of drainage, and it needs humidity and heat. So you don't find it growing commercially in the United States, other than a very small crop in Hawaii. And people try; they do a little, you know, greenhouse. They try to grow it here, but it really requires, you know, that wonderful Hawaii tropical weather.
Now, what happened to the? Did you ever do the deal with the Queensland Ginger Cooperative?
We assisted them for many, many years. We no longer buy the Australian ginger. We buy from Fiji as an alternative to that. Fiji is a wonderful source of fresh ginger, because it's such a remote island.
I've been there.
I mean, it's just beautiful. It's one of the purest ecosystems in the world. So we think it's one of the best. So we get our ginger from Fiji. We also source ginger from Indonesia, Peru. Mexico, China. Those are all, you know, very popular spots for growing ginger, and the climate suits ginger very well. And each spot has a slightly different type of ginger because you've got a different soil. You've got a different varietal in some cases. And they're very different. Some of the fresh ginger is very starchy. Others very, it has a lot of moisture content. So we use that type of ginger to make our ginger juice. And we supply ginger juice to some of the largest, most well-known food and beverage manufacturers in the world. So that's a key product for us. So we do ginger, single origin ginger juice from a variety of different countries. So if a beverage manufacturer requires a certain ginger flavor profile, we can work with them to achieve that, depending on, you know, where the ginger is grown.
You know, what I've loved is I've been drinking these rescue ginger shots.
I'm glad you love them. Those are our new babies.
Oh, I love, absolutely love it. And let's see, there are three different flavors. There's coconut, lemon, and cayenne, which I loved, and the wild turmeric, which I adored.
They're all gone, of course.
They're all gone.
She drank them all.
I did.
Well, you're supposed to have at least one ginger shot a day. You should have ginger every day in your diet. So,
well,
that's great.
Where do you get it? I mean, like...
Well, it's brand new. So we're just starting to get it online at the moment. And our distributors are just getting it into their distribution centers. So then it'll be distributed out to the stores. So it's early days. So right now, you can get it on our website, gingerpeople.com.
Just gingerpeople.com.
Just gingerpeople.com. And, you can order there. I think we've got a special on right now. So, yeah, please go online and visit.
I'll tell you,
my
mornings are becoming very busy because I'm doing a test also of this organic raw Magay cactus sap.
Oh my goodness.
So that, and I don't abandon my pickle juice. My fermented cider vinegar pickle juice.
You must be one healthy lady.
Yeah. No, that's a good question.
Yeah, that's a good question. So, and now I have to add this ginger rescue shot. That's amazing.
Yes. I mean, you can have it at any time of the day, but it is a great pick-me-up in the morning. It's ginger has an effect that's similar to caffeine, but it's caffeine-free. So where caffeine goes into your brain, ginger goes into your circulation. So by increasing your circulation, it gives you a natural caffeine-free lift.
And turmeric, of course, is a anti-inflammatory, so we all need that.
We all need that.
Yes. No, this is your husband.
Leads to disease.
Bruce?
And, yeah.
Bruce? Yes. Reason, very cute. Very cute.
he's Australian.
Well, so, like, how many products do you have total?
About eight gazillion.
80. How many?
Yeah. About 800 gazillion.
Yeah, and there's no sign of stopping. Because ginger can go into anything.
Really?
So, yeah, we have over 80, and we have consumer packaged goods, and then we have an ingredient side to our business, because that's where we started, was selling ingredients to food and beverage manufacturers.
Really?
So it's what's really great about that is we get to test all of those ingredients in our own products.
Uh-huh.
So we know what works and what doesn't work, so we have our own Ginger People food and beverage products. We have tonics and, like you say, the ginger shots. And we have a line of candies and the cooking sauces and a whole line of ingredients for the home chef. And we have dietary supplements and you name it. We even did cosmetics at one point.
Really?
So we've learned a lot about what ginger can do for you.
Well, it seems like it can do a lot of stuff. Because, I mean, and you can buy it in syrup form. You can buy it. Go on this website, and you'll be amazed at what you could make. How many employees do you have now?
We have between 30 and 35 employees, so we're a very small business. But the thing that we always remind people of is we support a lot of ginger farmers around the world. So it may be just a few staff here, but we look at the hundreds of ginger farmers that we help support.
And where are you?
We are in California. We're in Marina, California, so on the Central Coast. We have we have a warehouse here and sales and marketing offices here. We have an office in Vienna, Austria. Where from there we distribute our products in the EU, and then we have an office in Sydney, Australia, and we distribute in Australia and New Zealand there.
Do you go back and forth a lot?
We do. Yeah. We do.
I'll tell you, we went a year ago, in March, I guess it was, they had the World's 50 Best Restaurant Awards there in Melbourne, actually, and coupled with the Melbourne Food and Wine Festival, which is, we lived just outside of Melbourne when we were there. And from Pittsburgh to actually Cousin Richard's place in Tasmania, we were en route for 37 hours. I may never do this again.
I'm not surprised. Oh, yeah. It takes a long time to get there. But we've gotten used to it, because I've probably gone there, I would say, between 70 to 80 times.
Uh-huh.
And out of California, it's 13
yeah,
to 15
see, that's
hours,
it. You...
depending on which way the wind's blowing.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And, you know, you just sit down and you know you're going to get three or four meals and you know you're going to watch three or four movies.
I've got five full-length movies.
And you just settle in.
It was better than the time we went the Imperial Route, which is we went, let's see, Pittsburgh to Boston to London to Singapore to Perth and to Sydney and Melbourne, I think it was.
That was
a big trip.
It was a long way.
It was a long way. I think it took days. I finally lost track.
Have you ever eaten at a restaurant called the Bridge Street Room?
No.
It's fabulous.
Oh, yeah. We can give you restaurant recommendations.
Well, they probably have a lot of them.
I bet you could.
That's a real special one.
Is amazing. That is one of my favorite food places to go is Melbourne and Sydney.
Yeah, well, Melbourne, when we lived there, Sydney was more prominent and more advanced in restaurants. Now it's Melbourne is really the restaurant center, I think.
There's a great one there called Ginger Boy.
Oh, right.
it's really delicious.
Do you have anything to do with them?
Excuse me?
Do you have anything to do with the Ginger Boy?
We don't, just that we love the kinship with the love of ginger.
Yes. Well, I'm so glad to have met you, Abby, and I'm so happy to know about your products. Listeners, do check out this website, and trust us, this is ginger and turmeric are like the most effective spices that you can ever imagine, and good for your health and digestion. And I love it. I'm so enthralled with it. So,
well, it was great to meet you, and thank you, Anne, for the support.
And such a variety of products. I mean, just incredible. All right. And keep us posted.
We sure will. We've got more ginger and turmeric products coming.
Oh, you do? All right.
All right. Thanks, Anne.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, sweetheart. I guess that's a wrap for one more week. We'll hear you again, or you'll hear us again, we hope. Same time, same place next week, and until then.
Bye-bye.
Okay, sweetheart. I guess that's a wrap for one more week. We'll hear you again, or you'll hear us again, we hope. Same time, same place next week, and until then.
Bye-bye.